Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 8th of September, Anno Domini 2012, and you, oh, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Henry.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, stuff to choose, nothing to lose, and birthdays. That's right. No, I'm not today.
No, but yours is...
Mine is Monday.
Right, and the only reason I threw that in, because we won't be here on Monday to, you know, wish you a happy birthday.
Soundbite's birthday was last week. Mine's today. Yours is next.
No, Steve's
next.
Steve's next.
No, you're next. You're the 18th.
Mm-mm.
Wasn't it?
Mm-mm.
Mine's the 19th.
Yours the 23rd. No, 21st.
20th.
Oh, that's the evening of Wine and Jazz.
That's right.
And I know I'll be there.
I'm hoping to be there.
I will
be
there.
To my wife about it, but yeah, that's the theory.
You mean your wife hasn't told you you're going to be there yet?
Mine
certainly did.
Right. All right, do you own an iPhone or an iPad? If the answer is yes, there's a small chance that your personal information may have been made public by hacking group AntiSec. The hacking group claims to have obtained a list of more than 12 million unique device identifiers, UDIDs, usernames, cell phone numbers, addresses, and more by hacking a computer used by an FBI employee. The FBI has yet to confirm that claim, but AntiSec has posted a partial list of more than 1 million device profiles to call attention to the alleged hacking. Regardless of how the UDIDs were obtained, the information published is a potential security risk. Following concerns about privacy risks with UDID earlier this year, Apple began rejecting apps that try to access the identifier. The device ID on its own is not dangerous. However, combining it with other information like the user data included in the list released by AntiSec can create problems. The data could lead to the discovery of personal information, hacking attempts, or even identity theft. The Next Web has created a temporary ID checker that can cross-check the AntiSec list to see if your device or personal information is included. The FBI has issued a statement. The FBI is aware of published reports alleging that an FBI laptop was compromised and private data regarding Apple UDIDs was exposed. At this time, there is no evidence indicating that the FBI laptop was compromised or that the FBI either sought or obtained this data. The question, of course, is what would an FBI agent be doing with 12 million Apple UDIDs on his or her computer? The answer to that, of course, depends on how thick the tinfoil is in your hat. Our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is AntiSec says they stole 12 million iPad, iPhone unique device IDs. And the choices are, oh no, my beautiful iPad, oh dear. Kinda, I guess. Android forever, baby. And I what now? And of course, knowing you people, the top. Oh yes, I'm right. The top answer is I what now, followed by Android forever, baby. And of course, when you're done with the poll, I know you'll have more to say. So head on, check the yellow box underneath the poll. Click on Give Us Your Opinion, and head on over to my website, AskNick.com. That's Ask Nick. com. And the question is, what do you think of this story? And of course, that's our question to you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Apple also issued a statement that the FBI hasn't requested this information from Apple. Apple did not give this information to the FBI, and we don't use the UDIDs anymore anyway.
On the other
hand, where did it come from, and is AntiSec lying?
Well, is AntiSec lying? Where did the FBI get this information? What the heck was this person doing with all that data on their computer anyway? And where did the Next Web get the list that they're checking against?
Right.
And how many people have said, oh, yeah, those are my data.
The original report I read, they actually named the FBI agent whose computer they used.
Yeah, I didn't
and
remember.
So that's that interesting, too. So is that person really an FBI agent, and where did he get the numbers from? And so it's interesting that eventually we'll probably get to the whole story, but both Apple and the FBI are saying they didn't get it from us, and we didn't have it anyway. So maybe this guy was another hacker. Maybe he is anti-sec.
Maybe he is, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, off to the phones. Our first caller is Wesley from Cowlesville, New York. Wesley, welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I called last week about vertical slot CDs.
Right.
I found out the Dell that I was looking at has a just a slot, not a tray. Okay, since I've never seen any size other than the standard size, I guess it's not a problem.
Right, because it has only that slot and not a tray. Right. So if you're only ever going to play standard size CDs or DVDs, whichever that happens to be, then it really isn't a problem. But if you ever get one of the novelty ones, or for a long time people were handing out their data on credit card sized CDs and
or odd shaped ones,
then you have a problem. But if you're only ever going to play regular size one, then it's not a problem.
And a lot of the PC towers, well, generally a tray loading optical drive is what we call a full height 5 1/4 inch drive. So it's an inch and a half tall, and a lot of the PC tower chassis, they want to make them smaller than that. So by using a slot loading drive, they can get even smaller. Apple uses slot loading optical drives on a lot of their Macs that are, 9 to 12 millimeters tall, because they're physically very small and they fit inside computers a lot easier. Typically, you see those with laptop drives because they want to be smaller. But a lot of the smaller towers generally use those drives too. So they're smaller, they fit in the tower. So if you have a horizontally spaced 5 1/4 inch optical disc drive, then your computer has to be about 6 inches wide at a minimum to fit all that stuff in it. So by turning it vertically or by using a slot loading drive, they can make the chassis physically smaller.
My next problem is Windows 7. I understand with Windows 7 I can't have Outlook Express. I have to get Outlook, which, or something similar.
You can still use Outlook Express.
You can use it if you have it, but they don't include it anymore.
Yeah, because they want to go live.
Well, the replacement is Windows Live Mail, which is similar in concept to Outlook Express. And then the primary alternative for years has been Mozilla Thunderbird, but that's kind of in an iffy state now. They've announced they're going to stop future development, but the current version still works and is still supported.
But Thunderbird, you have to go online to get Thunderbird, or?
Yeah, you go to the Mozilla's website, getthunderbird.com, and then you download Thunderbird. Once you install it on your computer, you configure it to your email address and your email provider, and then it goes online and downloads your mail for you. So it downloads it to your computer, and then you can read it when you're offline.
Similar to Outlook Express.
Right.
I don't have to go to something online and then use email that way.
Right. Most email providers, like Yahoo and Gmail, are intended to be online only, but you can also download the mail with a mail client like Thunderbird. And then Time Warner and Frontier and the other traditional ISP mail providers, you can download your mail. The advantage of using a web-based mail reader is that you can go to any computer anywhere and see your mail. You don't have to go to your computer to see your mail. So there's a mix of both. Some providers use a mail service called IMAP. Gmail does, Frontier does, but annoyingly Roadrunner does not at the moment. Where IMAP mail, all of your mail stays on the server and it downloads to your computer. So you can read it on your computer when you're at home, and if you go away from your computer, you can log into the web-based interface and still see all of your mail on someone else's computer as well. Roadrunner does have a web mail service, but that only lets you see new mail, not all of your old mail.
Do you have time for different subject questions?
Sure, go ahead.
Cell phones.
Yeah.
We're in a dead spot. We can receive calls, but we can't make calls. And we're too far away, and there's a hill in the way. And all
right, right, right.
Any experience with the cell phone boosters?
Yes. We have one here.
Yeah.
Works great. It seems to work fine.
Okay.
There's a couple of different styles. There's cell phone boosters that are basically just a bigger antenna. The bigger your antenna, the weaker a signal you can pick up. And because people have driven cell phones to a physically tiny size, there's no antenna anymore. We joke the olden days, cell phones had a giant antenna sticking out of them, and then they had a retractable antenna, and now it's all embedded in the phone, and there's no antenna sticking out.
Right.
And that means that you need a stronger signal for it to work. So the cheaper cell phone boosters are just a bigger antenna you put in your house somewhere. And then some of them are actually an internet-based repeater. So in essence, you get your own little microcell tower, and that's what a lot of the companies call them, a microcell. You have your own microcell tower in your house that connects to your internet service. So when you place a cell phone call in your house, it actually goes out over the internet before it gets to the traditional phone system. They generally cost a little more, but if you're in a really dead spot, they would work because you have your own cell tower.
What I'm looking for is, in the case of a power failure, to be able to make a cell call.
So a bigger cell antenna would probably be better for that.
And one that could be powered with 12 volts or something like that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them aren't powered at all because it's just a big antenna that picks up radio signals.
Uh-huh.
There's some that do amplify that back into your house, so then your cell phone would pick it up. Just did a Google search for cell phone booster, and there's a lot of stuff online about them. There was a company I used to work with called Quicker Tech. I haven't bought anything from them for a while. They were usually intended for Wi-Fi antennas on your computer, so your computer could get better Wi-Fi protection. But they also do some cellular boosters as well. But I'm sure if you go to, I'm sure if you go to someplace like Radio Shack, but I don't know anymore. They don't. Radio Shack isn't the electronics superstore it used to be. Goldcrest Electronics at Clinton and Goodman would probably be a good place to go. If he doesn't have it, he'll be able to get it.
That's in Rochester.
That's true. You're in Colesville.
Yes.
So your local internet electronic catalog, you'd probably find it.
Okay. I'll take a look under cell phone boosters on the internet and see what...
There you go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
I've even seen high security buildings, you know, IBM Research Labs or something like that, where they have... cell phone blocker on all the windows, so that, not necessarily cell phone, but EMF blocker, so that signals can't get out of the building for corporate espionage. But that also means you can't use your cell phone out of the building either.
Right.
So you need one of the internet based, basically a VoIP service in the house.
Right. All right. Our next caller, Linda from Greece, New York. Hi, Linda. What's up?
Hi, I'm sorry I didn't call. I think belated happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I have, well, the gentleman before me kind of answered my question. I have a question on Gmail.
Yeah.
I noticed a thing that says all mail. I don't understand. So all mail collects all the mail I've ever received?
It's your inbox plus your outbox plus your sent mail plus any other mailboxes you created yourself. So
okay.
You can see all your mail in one place.
Okay. Now, my question to you is, I went in there, and I saw hundreds of mail. Now, if I delete that deletes it from wherever else in my computer it is. Wherever else in Gmail it is, if I delete it from there, right?
In Gmail, yes. On your computer, no. If you're using the web-based interface, it only works on the web. It doesn't do anything to your computer. But the other issue is Gmail doesn't actually delete anything. It just puts it in the deleted folder.
Uh-huh.
They're giving you 10 gigabytes of space, so they're one of their tenets is you don't have to delete anything because you got so much space.
Yeah, because I went in there and I, if I don't want it, I clean all mail out. And I was wondering, oh my God, if I delete something by accident, what happens to it?
It goes away.
Well, it goes into the deleted items folder.
Yeah.
Until you empty the deleted items folder, which is a second step.
I think it's every 30 days that happens anyway, I think, but I don't know.
Because I noticed when I had Yahoo, if I deleted it, it was deleted. Can you tell me why Gmail makes an all-mail folder? Because it's kind of hard. I delete it, and then I got to go in there if I want to delete it. And then it's a second step.
No, it isn't. If you delete it from one place, it's deleted from everywhere.
Oh, because...
But remember what Steve just said. It goes into the trash, but it doesn't empty the trash. So if you would go into all mail, you also see your trash.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you empty the trash, you won't see it anymore.
Okay.
When they say all mail, they're not kidding.
All mail from all the mailboxes you have.
Including trash.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm not explaining myself right. Okay, I'm in my inbox. I see what you're saying. Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, if it's going to your inbox and delete something, it goes into the deleted folder.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, can I expand on what the gentleman said?
Sure.
I live near you guys. I live across from Park Ridge Hospital. I have AT&T. My cell phone works fine outside. When I get in my house and I'm right across from the hospital.
Yeah.
Instead of getting 4 bars, I get 1 bar.
We've seen a lot of customers at our store have that problem near hospitals or radio stations because there's so much electromagnetic interference being generated by the hospital's equipment, and they probably have radios, giant radios, to talk to the paramedics on the field and stuff like that. There's so much interference that it's hampering the reception of your cell phone, and we have also seen issues hampering Wi-Fi reception in people's houses. Because there's so much interference that you can't get a good Wi-Fi signal.
Well, the reason why I know this is because, you know, I have Wi-Fi. So, you know, I have Wi-Fi through my whole house. So I use Wi-Fi on my phone. But maybe last week, a couple weeks ago, we lost our power for 5 hours. And Wi-Fi didn't work. And all of a sudden, I looked at my phone and I said, oh, my God, I've only got 1 bar. What am I going to do if I need to make a call? You know, so I thought to myself, well, I can go outside. But now, continuing on what that gentleman said, I've heard of repeaters. I went to Best Buy, and they've never heard of a repeater.
Some places call it a booster, a cell phone booster, rather than a repeater. It, from a very technical, pedantic standpoint, it is a repeater. It picks up the cellular signal, amplifies it, and repeats it so that you can pick it up with your cell phone.
Well, the reason why I wanted to get the repeaters because I want to get Sirius XM, but my bedroom window where I keep it is south, and you got to be west, and that's what they said. Get a repeater.
Well, that's different. That would be a satellite receiver repeater, and that's different from a cell phone repeater or booster.
Oh, okay. Now, where can I get a satellite repeater? Best Buy doesn't even know what I'm talking about.
Probably just Google around on the internet. Or try Goldcrest Electronics. They would probably know what direction to point you in if they don't aren't able to get them themselves.
Okay.
Generally, you put the satellite antenna on the side of the house that needs to be, and then run a wire around to the side that you need it on, and put your receiver there.
Okay, because I even tried with the antenna that comes with it. I tried putting it in my window, but certain times, so I would put the repeater in my window. Hello?
You put the satellite antenna would be on one side of your house receiving the satellite signal, and that would have a wire coming out of it that you would usually plug into your satellite receiver. You could plug that wire into a repeater in your house that would then amplify the signal and send it to your receiver.
Okay, I'm a little confused, but that's okay.
All right, we have to run, Linda.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 22 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 26 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites.
I wanted to mention for Linda that I found that Sirius on their own website has satellite signal repeaters. Well, the one I found says out of stock, but it's $180.
All right. One of the other things, though, if she's hooking this up, she's trying to do what? Netflix, did she say?
No, Sirius.
Oh, Sirius Radio.
And you can get the Sirius app on your tablet,
right.
iPad, iPhone, Android, and then run it through the internet instead of as a satellite download. You still have to subscribe to the service.
Right, because I've got it both. I've got the Sirius XM Radio, which I have, you know, in this... it's basically a...
little box.
No, it's... the unit fits into like a boombox. It looks like a boombox. And off the boombox is an antenna. And I have the antenna sitting in the window because they give the... When you buy this kit, they give you like, 40 feet of antenna wire with this antenna.
That might be what she was understanding. You have your receiver, which actually plays the music with a speaker in it. And then you have the antenna, which picks up the signal.
Right. And it's got to be... for me, it's got to be in a south-facing window. And it's got to go facing southwest. And I have it angled there in one of my windows, and it picks up the signal no problem. She doesn't need a booster for that. If she's got XM radio.
Well, that's what she wants to get, but she said the south-facing window's on the other side of the house.
Well,
so then you got to run the antenna wire through the house or around the outside of the house.
Or just, set it
up. Or just use the internet service.
Yeah, or well, they charge you on top of that.
Oh, there's an extra fee for that?
Yes.
No.
Versus your XM radio. But, yeah, I mean, they give you plenty of wire. If you buy the boombox, they give you plenty of wire, 40 foot. And even if it's at the other end of the house, if she can get it on a side window and it's facing up at the sky, that'll work too. And depending on her house, if she can put it up high enough and face it that way, if there's not too much interference within mm-hmm. the house, you know, like we've said before, Faraday cages, some of these houses are great Faraday cages. But providing that there isn't, she might be able to just set it up on top of a somewhere where it's higher and just face it to the southwest. Because on the radio, it will tell you there's one of the things there to your signal strength. And you can keep moving it a little bit, and it'll show you how your signal strength is doing.
And if you do need a repeater, they are available. It looks like Sirius sent me to a website called MyRadioStore.com. And they have a lot of accessories for Sirius and XM repeaters and longer antennas and splitters and all types of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you do want to get your satellite radio and the room you want it in is not conveniently located for the satellite antenna, then there are ways to get around it.
Yep, I do. With mine.
No problem. All right. Our next caller is Rich from Irondequoit. Welcome, Rich. What's your question?
Hi, guys. Good afternoon.
Hiya.
Must be email day because I have another email question.
Sure.
I'm getting on my email service with Roadrunner mail delivery failures, and I've had like 100 of them.
Somebody you know is probably infected with a mass mailing virus.
Okay.
And they're using you as the return address.
Okay.
So when all of those messages bounce, you get notice that they're bouncing. The delivery return error is a mechanism part of email that if you try to send if you try to send a message and the address is wrong or it gets to the other end and that person doesn't exist or there's something wrong, the mail server bounces a message back to you to tell you that your message was not delivered. And it sends that message back to the return address listed in the message. Well, I can easily send an email with your return address in it. And that's one way the bad guys hide spam mail is they don't use their own return address. So
it's not necessarily anything on my machine.
Right. Unless they're messages you know you sent and they're coming back because there's something wrong with the address. Sometimes it could be mailbox full. Roadrunner used to have a big problem. They only gave you 5 megabytes of mail space. I think it's up to 100 megabytes now, compared with Gmail that gives you 10,000 megabytes.
Right.
So Roadrunner gives you 100 megs, but when it was only 5 megs, you could fill that up in 3 or 4 days, especially if someone sent you a couple of pictures. And then the other end would get a message saying that they couldn't deliver the mail to you because your mailbox was full. So sometimes it's undeliverable because the address doesn't exist. It's undeliverable because the mailbox is full. So if you read closer into that message, it may tell you exactly what it means. But if you're getting bounce back messages for mail you did not send, then
there's no way I've sent these. I haven't sent an email in days.
So somebody you know that has you in their address book is sending mail in your name, and so you're getting the bounce errors.
Okay. Now, is there anything I can do with this, or just delete them?
Well, tell all of your friends.
Okay.
To dance the security tango.
Somebody is infected with a mass mailing virus.
Okay.
If you dig into the headers of the message, you can sometimes figure out who actually sent it, but you have to really know how to read SMTP headers and all that mess, which...
Yeah, that wouldn't be me.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's very little you can do yourself except tell your friends you think some of them's and somebody's infected. In fact, most internet providers, when they recognize that you're sending out too much mail, you know, 100 messages a day, 1,000 messages a day, something like that, the internet provider will shut off your mail service,
okay,
saying that you have a virus. So someone may, they may have already been caught that that they're infected. So then the person can't send any mail, and then they call their mail provider and say, yeah, you're infected.
Oh, okay.
And then, it gets taken care of that way.
Okay. And one thing, I'm watching you guys on Ustream, and Dave, I like your shirt.
Thank you.
So, hey, thanks for the information, guys. I appreciate it. You guys have a good day.
You thanks. Too, thanks.
Waving back to you too, Dave. Okay, guys.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yep. Yeah, it's one of the...
I forgot that kids.
Yep. It's one of the idiosyncrasies
good
of mail.
Good thing you got that shirt on.
Oh, I was going to wear another one.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it.
I see that on TV shows now all the time. They go through and blur out product logos. And there's product logos everywhere. Everyone's almost always wearing a T-shirt with some logo on it. And that's got to be a lot of work in post-production.
Speaking of money.
I was mentioning before the show, I was listening to a Security Now podcast, and they were talking about a company in Australia who are charging an Internet 7 tax. Internet Explorer 7 tax, that if you go to their website using Internet Explorer 7, you get charged extra for something you buy because their engineers took so much time and work and money to make the website work in IE7 that the owner said that he wants to recoup all that lost money. He said about 3% of their customers are still using IE7, even though 8 and 9 are released and now 10 is in beta. Then he just wants to get some of his money back. I love all his engineers taking so much time.
Nice. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Charles from Penfield. Welcome. What's your question?
Yeah, hi, guys. Two questions today. The first would be about modems. I had a problem this past week with modems. We had to go through about three of them to find one that worked. And during the tech support, the gentleman told me that it is better to leave a modem plugged in and on all the time. Do you agree with it for best performance and less problems?
Are you talking about what kind of modem?
Oh gosh.
A cable or DSL router?
Supplied by Time Warner.
Okay, cable modem. All right.
Yeah. Technically, it's a router, but everyone uses the word modem.
No, that's what they need.
Yeah.
Modem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. From their standpoint, yes, it's better for the connection. It's better for performance. If you unplug and restart your cable router or your DSL router, you may get a different IP address, which could affect any type of services you're running. So it is better for them to leave it on all the time. It's better for you to turn it off when you're not using it because it saves electricity. But generally speaking, people leave them on all the time and only like your computer itself, you'll turn it off and unplug it when you're going to be gone for an extended period of time, or through thunderstorm season. All the thunderstorms we had yesterday, we at the office, we were just getting ready to unplug and turn off everything, but then the storm passed through so fast that we ended up not. But that's usually the time when you it's a good idea to unplug it and run. And when weird things are happening, resetting your cable or DSL router is often a way to fix strange little issues that may be happening too.
Yeah, I had to do that probably about once a month to help straighten things out.
Yeah.
he was telling me that the old modem that we had for years, the new one that we upgraded to, which looks exactly the same, it will literally give us 2 times more speed. He felt because we were turning the thing off every night, it wasn't in the best service for the modem, and that we would maintain better performance and speed if we kept the thing.
Well, there are two things that
doesn't
really
make any sense.
Well, there are two things. One is when you turn it on, it has to go get a
buffers,
an address. But the second thing is it has to check for updates. Because
okay.
The modem sometimes gets updated, and that takes time. So if you turn it on and then try to work while it's doing its thing, that will take longer. Now, that doesn't mean the entire session will be slower, but it will certainly start out slower.
And also, the way that Roadrunner Turbo works, where they call it the Turbo Boost, where you get a 50% speed increase, is often predicated on how much use you've been using in the past. So when you start a big download, you get a burst of speed, and before it sort of slows down a little bit later on. So I'll do a speed test. Interesting, I don't pay for Turbo, but when I do a speed test, it tells me I'm getting 20 megabit.
Nice.
And then a few minutes later, I do another one, and it says 15. A few minutes later, and it says 10, which 10 is what I'm paying for.
Right.
So that Turbo Boost gives you an initial burst of speed before it settles back down again. And it is possible that if your modem is too recently restarted, that won't be able to build up that cache.
Right.
How do you do that test, that speed test?
Just go to the website.
Speedtest.com or frontier.speedtest.com. I don't know if there's one for...
Yeah, speedtest.rochester.frontier.com and speedtest.roadrunner.com.
Okay.
Now, one of them is speed test is rochester.speedtest. One of them is speedtest.rochester, .frontier.com, and then .rochester.ra.com.
Okay, great.
Because you can do speedtest.net is a general speed test site, but if you can do a speed test inside your own local service provider, then you get much better.
A little more accurate,
yeah, because it's not going to the rest of the internet.
I think it's a little less accurate because 99% of the time you're going to the rest of the internet. I'd rather know what my speed really is on the internet.
True. Yeah, it's more accurate but less useful to be inside your
provider, right.
Yeah, so you know, Roadrunner says I'm getting 10 megabits to the Roadrunner server. I am almost never going to Roadrunner server when I'm surfing web pages.
Okay, that's great. The second question, final question, would be about Google Chrome. I have not yet gone into Google Chrome, and I know you guys talk about it, and I just wanted your opinion regarding the same technician I was talking about raves about it, and he says that one of its unique qualities is that it could take a tab that you might have open and you're cruising around the internet, and it can sandbox one tab, so to speak, if there's any kind of if you land on a malicious
site. It sandboxes all your tabs.
All your tabs, yeah.
Oh.
And what that means is each tab is essentially in its own little space. And so if a tab dies, if a website dies on that tab, it doesn't take down your whole browser. It only takes down that tab.
But the latest browsers from all the companies do that.
They all do that now.
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break. Thanks for calling. Back
okay,
in just a couple
you.
Of minutes. Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Nick Francesco, you, 39 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we have Gerd from Victor on the line. Hi, Gerd. What's up?
Well, I got a couple of real quick jobs. Well, one is quick, one isn't. Frontier service, how do you do a speed test on that?
Speedtest.frontier.com. And then it will ask you what city you're in Frontier serves, so you get the closest site. Or you can just go to speedtest.net, which is sort of a generic national site.
Okay. Here's the biggie. I watch C-SPAN for the conventions, and one of the problems that crops up, and it also does it every once in a while on YouTube, is this buffering thing. So I checked on the internet for buffering, and it gives you all the explanations as to why and how, but it doesn't tell you how to improve it.
You can't.
Built in. Every application has a specific buffer size that it uses. Some have an algorithm. And so they buffer as much as they think is necessary to ensure a smooth video performance. Sometimes they're wrong.
One of the only things you can do is lower the video quality so it's not sending you as much data so that the buffer doesn't fill up too fast.
Lower the video quality.
Right. On YouTube and most other videos, there's a little gear icon where you can lower the quality from 720 to 480 to 280. The lower the quality of the video, the less data it sends. But we all want to watch high-quality video, so that's the interesting trade-off. There is something called the MTU setting in your TCP stack. Normally, it's set to 1500, which is sort of the general intermediate range. You can optimize your internet for large files by increasing that number, and then large downloads will be faster, but small downloads will be much slower. So that's why 1500 is sort of the standard size, because it's reasonable for both large and small downloads.
MTU.
And it's hard for most people to change because it's buried in the TCP settings.
Okay. Well, that takes care of that.
Yep. A faster internet service could help, but then for something really popular like the conventions or recently the Olympics, there are so many people watching it. Some of the buffering could be caused at the other end. Not being able to send out 100,002 streams. You know, if you happen to be the person that fills up the buffers from the other end, then you might run into issues yourself, too.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate it.
All right.
Yep.
Thank you. Doing a hell of a job.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the annoyances of watching video on the internet, YouTube, Netflix, you know, and any regular website that you could run into that buffering issue. There is a potential that if you don't have enough RAM in your computer, adding more RAM could help. So if you have less than, say, 4 gigs of RAM, adding more RAM may help in that buffering, because if there's more RAM in the computer, then it's possible for the video players to allocate more RAM to its buffer. But if you've already got, you know, 4 gigs of RAM or so, then adding more isn't going to help any.
Right. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller, Ken, from Webster, New York. Welcome, Ken. What's your question?
Thank you very much. I don't have a current problem.
Okay, thanks for calling.
This is basically a question on how would you address the issue that I'm going to present to you. I have XP Home Edition. I want to buy a Windows 7 machine, probably Home Premium.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that's standing in my way, I would like to be able to use Microsoft Picture It on the Windows 7.
Yeah.
And from everything I see on the internet, yeah, you can install it, but you probably won't make it work.
Let me stop you right there, because I'm using Windows 7 Professional, which really doesn't make any difference, professional or home, in this case. And Picture It works fine.
Yeah, the reason for it is you're using professional. In fact, one of the worker, let's put it this way, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer when it comes to issues like this. I'm in my 70s, but it seems to me that if you run virtual PC on the machine, you can accomplish it that way, but you have to use a professional or ultimate to be able to carry that off.
The issue is I just found a tech note at Microsoft. If you're using Windows 7 Professional, you have the compatibility mode that says run as XP, and that's what lets it work.
Right. I'm aware of.
Yeah, if you use Windows 7 Home, then you'd have to get Microsoft Virtual PC and an XP license to run XP as a VM inside of 7.
But here's the thing, though. When you go to have a machine built, there is no difference in price to get home versus professional.
Okay.
So just go with the professional.
It's a difference for us to buy it. They cost different when we buy them, so we have to charge differently for them.
Not really.
We get OEM system builds from Microsoft.
The
professional version is about $50 more.
My distributors, it's same price for either.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Let me know who your distributor is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We can talk offline.
Yeah.
So, Dave, you could build me a machine with professional. Is that true?
Yes, I can, sir.
Yeah.
And then if you want, we can also transfer any of your data from your old machine over to a new one.
Can you, does it have to be a full-size tower? Can you do it in a smaller frame or no?
We do mid-size towers is what I would recommend.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I have right now.
Yeah, I do a small mid-tower, and that way I can easily get 6-inch fans on the front and back.
Okay.
So there we go with that 5 1/4-inch hard drive or optical drive for a 6-inch fan.
Well, you know, it's just because just pushing more air because yep. You're doing so much more processing and everything else. You know, go for it. And the other thing is, you know, you want to also consider 64-bit Windows as opposed to Windows 32-bit.
Especially if you're going to put more than 3 gigs of RAM, which you should anyway.
Yep. I go 8 gig of memory, Windows Professional 64-bit.
Right.
And you'd be cooking, you know, with a good 1 gig video card.
So you can't do it with Home Premium then. Is that right, Dave?
I haven't.
Not easily.
Yeah, no, I just go ahead and do the professional because, well, from our standpoint, you know, we've got a network, you know, within the business, so we, you know, use professional. But like I say, if there's no difference in price, what difference does it make? And you're not going to notice any difference.
Right, right.
Because you're not on a network, but yet you'll gain some of the other aspects of it. So I just, most of the time, just automatically just sell folks professional.
Well, I have to knock on your door and see how expensive you are, I guess.
There you go.
I do want to add this. You folks don't use Microsoft Picture It, I'm sure.
I do.
You do? Okay.
Oh, yes.
I have. It's Microsoft Picture It 2001 Publishing,
yep.
And I've used that for 10 years. And are there other venues out there? Yes, there are, but they're far more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, Picture is just so sweet, you know, as far as tracing around something.
That's right.
Or if I want to do up a quick banner or a sign for the shop or that,
right?
Boom, you can design it up and, you know, link things together. It's just been great. I love it. I've found many applications that I can use Picture it for besides just doing pictures.
Well, there's a lot of people out there right now that are frustrated with the very same issue that that I'm frustrated with.
Yeah, like I say, just put the word out. Just go to a professional.
Looks like they discontinued it in 2009.
Yeah.
Right. One last thing I'll add. I've enjoyed you folks for a long, long time. I listen to you on a regular basis. It's no fault of yours. It's my fault more than anything, but I don't get as much out of you guys as I used to because I haven't kept up with the technology, and probably 75% of the time you're talking over my head.
Man.
I kind of laugh at it. There's no problem with it. I just haven't kept up with all the technology that exists.
No, I understand that. It's very hard to keep up. If you know, it's expensive, and it's time-consuming.
That's why it takes three of us.
That's the truth.
Because we can overlap a little bit, but we all
that
have our own areas.
Well, in conclusion, it's hard to keep a lot of things up, I guess.
It's the truth.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Ken.
Okay, Dave, I'll be knocking on your door.
Okay, we'll be there.
Okay, thanks a bunch.
Yeah, it looks like Microsoft expects everyone to switch over to Windows Photo Gallery when they discontinued Picture It in 2006 and discontinued support in 2009.
Right.
So if he's running a 2001 version, that may be another problem, even in XP compatibility mode. But no, but if he's running it in XP now, it should be fine.
Right. We got time?
Yeah. We've got six minutes.
6 minutes. Wow. Yeah. I could do a lot in 6 minutes.
All right. Our
that
next
was
caller
five minutes
is Joanne from Greece. Welcome, Joanne. What's your question?
Touch it.
Okay. I have organizing my pictures. In my picture library, I have a folder that has 520 photographs in it, pictures. They used to be in alphabetical order. Now somehow it's changed, and they're scattered all over. I can't figure out how to...
What program are you using to organize your pictures, or is it just right on the desktop?
It's in the My Pictures file.
Right on the desktop. Okay. When you're in a list view, at the top of the columns, there's name, date, size, kind. If you click on the column header, it sorts by that column.
I know, but I don't seem to find that anymore. I can't find where I used to be able to do list and icon, and I can't find that there.
That's in the view menu.
Sounds like she turned off that.
Did you turn off your menu bar? Is there a menu in that window at all?
It just says organize, share, slide, burn, new folder. There's no...
There should be a file, edit, view.
Yeah, that's not there.
That part is missing. If you go up to...
So you're not actually in a program. You've just opened. You've just double-clicked on a folder on your desktop.
Yes, it's inside my pictures file.
Okay.
Then if I take that same folder and I put it in my documents, they're alphabetized. But then they're not the large icons I want, and I don't seem to, and I can't get the icons.
Yeah, there's supposed to be a view menu that has small icons, large icons, details, tiles.
Okay, so that's what I've.
Yeah, so that button is missing.
Yeah.
And you've accidentally turned off those extra menus.
What OS are you using?
What?
Windows 7, Windows XP.
7.
Yeah, Windows 7, it should be up in the upper...
My Windows 7 toolbar disappeared. How can I remove it? We're looking through Microsoft's here. There is a way to turn off your toolbars so that you get more space in your windows.
Okay.
Which implies there's a way to turn them back on again, but I haven't found it yet. No, they're talking about the taskbar, not the toolbar. Taskbar and toolbar are different. Taskbar's at the bottom, toolbar's at the top. Mm-hmm.
What version of Windows are you running?
7.
7. I bet this happened when all of a sudden I got two or three different toolbars at the top.
Yeah, you might have turned too many of them off. Just try right-clicking on the toolbar that you can see and see if there's a menu that says show toolbars that lets you pick other toolbars.
Copy, edit, delete, no.
Or view, anything like that? Customize?
There's a thing, it's down in where the pictures are, and it's arranged by, but that's just by folder, month, date. That doesn't play in there. Okay, now I know what I'm looking for anyway.
Yes.
Well, what you might want to do is in the Start button, open your control panel and select Appearance and Personalization.
Start, control panel. What was the next one? Something on personalization.
Appearance and personalization.
Write this down. Okay.
And then check for folder options.
Okay.
And you can change the way that folders are viewed. So you can change a bunch of things. Be careful what you change. But once you've done that, you can make sure that you see... all the menu choices, and then you can click on the button that says apply to folders.
And there's a section that says advanced settings,
Okay. Right. And
a section that says always show menus. Okay. And that's what you want turned on, to see all those extra menus.
Always show menus. Okay.
There you go.
Sounds good. Before you guys leave, I'll sign off, but review what this, your jazz thing September 21st is, the jazz and wine.
Oh, September 20th. That is an evening of wine and jazz, and then it's September 20th, and it's going from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Pier 45, which is the old...
I know where it is.
Yep. Yeah, where the ferry used to be. And, they're going to have all kinds of great stuff. I mean, there's going to be...
Wine tasting
beer
and
tasting. There's
food
gonna
tasting.
Chocolate.
Jazz.
Chocolate sampling. Nothing better than dark chocolate with some good wine.
And there's a silent auction as a fundraiser for the station.
But you got to get tickets now because it is limited.
Okay.
And once they're gone, they're gone. And we sold out last year.
Can I get them online or how do you?
Yep. Yes, you can. You can go right to our webpage, jazz901.org, and register for your tickets.
They're even having a sale on now. Buy 5 tickets, get 1 free. So you can bring a big family, a big table full of people.
Okay.
All righty.
Thank you.
All right.
All right, that noise tells me we're done for the first hour of our show. But despair not, because in just a few minutes we'll be back bringing you an entire another hour of sound bites. So for those of you who did not get your calls in the first hour, come on back and we'll do it all over again. We'll let you get your calls in. This time you know the numbers. 585-966-JAZZ, that's 966-5299, or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. It's Dave Enright, it's Steve Ray, it's Nick Francesco, it's you. It's 59 minutes after the hour, and it is the longest running computer show in the known universe. Soundbites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. The Computer Show, Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Now, listen, before we get back to the phone, I think it's important for us to talk about what's going on this week in terms of computer clubs. On Tuesday night, the...
Is it the All-Nick week again?
It's the All-Nick week again, and that's why we're going to talk about it. Thank you very much.
Enlightened folks. In both aspects.
Yeah. The Rochester Computer Society will be meeting this Tuesday night. And I'm trying to remember where, because that would be important. Because
you got to be there.
The Gates Public at the Gates Public Library, 902 Elm Grove Road. The Gates Public Library, 902 Elm Grove Road, and they will be starting at 6:30 will be the presentation, and I will be talking about Android tablets. So that's going to be lots and lots of fun. So if you're around for, if you have nothing else to do on Tuesday evening, stop down to the Gates Library around 6:30, and I will be talking about Android tablets. And if you can't make it, well, even if you can make it, the next night will be almost equally interesting, or it will be equally interesting because it'll be me again. I'll be at Apple Cider at the East High School, and we'll be talking about copyright and infringements and stuff like that. So that's Wednesday night, and I won't be there until about 8:30, but you knew that already.
Yeah.
And that's not a problem. So I teach Wednesday nights until 8, so I will be hopping in the car and racing like the wind to East High School
corner of Main and Culver.
Corner of Main and Culver.
Use the Ohio Street entrance next to the radio tower.
Next to the radio tower, exactly. And I'll be coming in to talk about copyright and stuff like that.
The Apple Cider meeting starts at 7. We'll also be having several of our own members doing some smaller presentations. Our own Skip Meets is going to be talking about his internet trip to Mexico. I'm going to be talking about AirPrint printers that allow you to print from your iPads and iPod touches. And then our own Rick Harrison, who's filled in for me on the show here as well, is going to be talking about Macintosh circuit design. So if you're interested in designing circuits with your Mac, he'll be talking about that as well.
I think all of these are going to be excellent things. So Tuesday night, don't forget, that's the Rochester Computer Society at the Gates Library at 6:30. And then Wednesday night, the CIDR meeting at East High School starting at 7:30?
Yep. Oh, 7.
7. So, yeah, join us. Be there or be... somewhere else, I guess.
Be there or be square?
Yeah, one of the two. But join us. I think we're going to have some fun. I know I'm going to have fun. And really, isn't that all that counts?
No, it's the after meeting that really counts.
Yeah, it's always the after meeting that counts. I know, that's a truth. All right, we're going to go back to the phones. And we're going to talk to Larry from Spencerport, New York. Welcome, Larry. What's your question?
Yes, I've been trying to join the AskNick.com, and I keep getting this membership temporarily suspended.
Yes, it is. There has been some discussion about the AskNick website, and I know what I'm going to do to fix it, and I just haven't yet. I just have been too busy. I thought I was going to get to it at the end of the summer.
The whole summer off.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we know about people who work at schools. Get the whole summer off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have me mistaken for somebody with a PhD. So, consequently, I do not have,
yeah,
I did not
have
the summer. Yeah, right. I'm only a master's degree. So, I did not get the summer off, and therefore I did not, in fact, in any way, shape, or form, managed to get done the stuff I wanted to get done this summer. But my hope is to be able to bring it back. We have resolved every other issue except my time to get it back up and running.
Any estimates on when that would be?
Well, I would have said by now had you asked me a little earlier. But no, it is not. I have no estimate at this moment. I wish I did. I just simply do not. I wish I did.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, I'm so sorry. I know, believe me, I wish I need to bring it back up. I get that, but I can't. I just haven't had the ability to do it. The time.
Too much time. We need to shift to a 29-hour day.
That is the truth.
Slow the planet a little bit. It is slowing a little bit, isn't it? You know, a microsecond to century or something like that?
Yep.
Some little tiny bit.
Something along like that, yeah.
Wondering where that second went.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we have to add leap seconds every now and then so that the rotation of the Earth, which isn't consistent, matches the clocks that we like to use.
Yeah, right. All right, our next caller is Henry from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Henry. What's your question?
Hi. I've been running AVG for some time, but today I got a dialogue box that came up that I hadn't seen before. It says on the top, AVG resident shield alert, and underneath that, exclamation point with multiple threat detection. And there's three tracking cookies, apparently, that are infecting the machine. They all have the same name. And when I right-click on one of the items, there's two things to do. One, add to exceptions, which I assume I don't want to do. And the other says, go to file.
Uh-huh.
What I assume I want to do is get rid of it or delete it. If I click go to file, it just comes up with a series of folders, but none of those folders are in the path of the file that's being displayed. The complete path is users, Henry, app data, roaming, Microsoft, Windows, cookies, low, and then it gives the file name, 89KMU4ZW.txt.
That's an invisible folder.
Yeah, that's an invisible folder.
That
but here's
maybe why it can't get to it.
Right. But here's the question. What are the names of these tracking cookies? Is it somewhere you want to be?
The names of the tracking cookies?
Right. You said that at the very beginning it gave names for the tracking cookies. Are they just numbers or
numbers. They're just numbers, yeah.
Okay. All I can suggest,
numbers and letters, yeah.
They could be from anywhere. Every program wants to track you nowadays. Every website wants to track you. Facebook is notorious for this. They also are notorious for burrowing into other people's cookies.
Yeah.
But if you don't know where it came from.
Well, way on the bottom of the dialog box, it says process name, program files, super anti-spyware, and then it says SASCORE64.exe.
That's probably a false positive that AVG is seeing a definition file in super anti-spyware and thinking you're infected. That's one of the problems with having multiple programs that do the same thing. Are you running AVG Pro or just the AVG Free?
AVG Free.
Okay. I didn't know that did tracking cookies, too. I thought it was just viruses.
Yeah, it does. So let me suggest this. If it is, in fact, coming from Super Anti-Spyware, then you can safely ignore it forever.
Add it to the exception list.
Yeah, add it to the exception list.
So that sometimes one.
It does say when it says found tracking cookie, it says dot ATDMT. I don't know what that means. But
ATDMT.
Yeah.
AT.
I don't. That I don't. ADT.
ADT.
Launchers and cookies. A lot of people asking about it.
Steve is looking it up. I don't know it off the top of my head.
But it does look like it is a tracking cookie that people are talking about. AVG finds it a threat. Now, a lot of people asking what it is. I haven't seen anyone say that they know what it is yet.
So it's ADT as in Tom?
That's correct. A-T as in Tom, D as in Denver, M as in Mary, T as in Tom.
A-T as in Tom, D as in...
Denver.
Okay.
M-T.
There are a bunch of places that use that one, A-T-D-M-T. It's actually...
World of Warcraft uses it.
Yeah, it's actually from a subsidiary of Microsoft called Atlas Solutions. The BBC uses it, and a couple of other places tend to use it as well. So I might... think if you go to the BBC you play World of Warcraft or...
I don't play any of those games.
Whatever. Yeah, right.
How do I get to app data? You said that was a hidden folder.
Yeah, you have to go into your folder options and tell it to show hidden folders.
What do you say? You said folder options?
Yeah, that which is usually in the tools
menu. If you open up any folder... under generally tools.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Generally, it's under tools. And you should be able to see that. It is a company called Atlas Solutions. They are from Microsoft.
Nobody can figure out what it does, though. Just they know what it is.
Yeah. I would suggest, honestly, that you disable it because I'll almost guarantee you that what it's doing is talking to Akamai and all the other places that do tracking back to so they can follow what your path is. So personally, me,
yeah.
I would block it.
Okay. When I opened this, when I right-clicked on it and it went to the folder, the only thing that's on the menu is it says organize, open, include in library, share with, burn, new folder. There's no tools.
Well, that's okay. The reason that many folders are hidden is so you don't go screwing around in them.
Right.
Because there's dangerous stuff in there.
Yeah.
So just if you're only satisfying your curiosity...
I want to delete it, like you said.
Well, you go in and you block it through AVG.
Yeah, just do it that way. You don't want to go in and start playing around with folder.
It'll be unused. It'll be blocked and taken away. It'll be gone.
Okay. You say go into AVG?
Well, right from the original screen where we were talking about it, it said you could. There were two things you could do with it.
Yeah.
What was the first one?
Add to exceptions or go to file.
Oh, add to exceptions or go to... There's no block?
That's right. That's what bothers me.
What was it? Add to exceptions?
Add to exceptions or go to the file.
Go to the file so you can delete it, but yeah. if it's in a hidden folder, you can't delete it.
You can't delete it out of a hidden folder easily, and even if you do, the next time you visit any of the sites that tracks through Atlas, you'll get it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would... Wow.
Hmm.
I haven't seen this kind of a dialogue box. There must have been some update to AVG recently.
Yeah, well, AVG is now going to 2013, I think it is.
I'm still running 12, but...
They're getting ready for a newer version. But I'd wait, because like Steve was saying, it could be a false positive with one of the updates. And wait a week. You know, it's not going to... it's just a tracking cookie. Wait another week and, probably a few days, and they'll have updates. If this is a problem that's out there, they're going to be updating it.
I have seen that 2013 is out there, but I think technically it's still a beta.
Yeah. Right. The other thing is, if it is in fact, and only you can tell this yourself somehow, that if it is in fact coming from super anti-spyware, then it is definitely a false positive. What it's picking up is their definition of that tracking cookie
right.
in their
That's
system.
Why I say wait a week.
And if it shows up again in the same place and it still seems to be coming from SAS Core, the Super Anti-Spyware Core, then I would add it to exceptions.
Okay. All right, I guess that's the best.
Does that make sense?
Right now.
Yeah, I think that's where the problem... Well, I mean, obviously we're not sitting in your machine, but if it is in fact coming from the Super Anti-Spyware Core, then it's a false positive and you can add it to exceptions.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yep.
That's one of the problems.
Yeah. I just found something on AVG's list, which is interesting. There's supposed to be a third option in that AVG menu called Move to Vault. So you could see it in your vault and then do other things to it. AVG says the Move to Vault option is not available if the detected file exceeds 5 megabytes. So that would sort of make sense because I bet Super Anti-Spyware's definition file is bigger than 5 megabytes.
Right, which tells me it's not a cookie. There is no 5 megabyte cookie that I've ever seen, at least.
I'd love to see a giant. My dad knew how to make cookies.
Cookie.
If the recipe said makes 2 to 3 dozen, his made 1 dozen.
Yeah, right. Right. My mother used to make cookies like that. They were as big as my head. Lemon drop cookies. Holy cow, they were delicious. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break while I dream of lemon drop cookies. Back in with a lemon frosting on them. Oh, my golly. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 19 minutes after the hour. Sound bites right here on Member Supported Jazz 90.1.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have our friend Dar from Toronto, Canada, on the line. Hiya, Dar. What's up?
How do, gentlemen?
How are you?
Got a question and a comment.
Sure.
Quick ones. We want to have fun up here as well.
You should.
We can't make it to Rochester. Is there any way that you could record your talk on notebooks and post it on for us? Unfortunates up here.
That's interesting. So at Cider, we do Ustream recording and broadcasting, just like we do here on Soundbites, because I'm the one that's doing it.
You're the one doing it. So yeah, it's pretty much identical to the way we do it here.
Yeah.
So you could watch Wednesday night when I talk about copyright. Not that I actually know anything about copyright on YouTube, and Steve can post that address in our link list.
Okay.
As for Tuesday, I don't know. I will have to talk to somebody about that. I can't promise anything, but if we can record it in some way, shape, or form, if anybody from the RCSI is listening and has plans to do any or all of that stuff, please call in and let us know.
Ustream is nice because it's free. It only stores your files for a few months.
Right.
Unless you pay extra for it, but it's free streaming. This camera's built into most computers these days.
Right. I'm sorry, Dar, you were saying?
Well, it's just that even if you do attend a talk, about 60% of it goes over your head or under your bum or something, and it's always better to hear it 2 or 3 or 4 times.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree. Like I said, I will do my best to see what happens, but I don't even know how I'm going to let you know. You're just going to have to go to the website and look, rcsi.org.
Oh, geez, we'll have to have another beer to do that, eh?
You might need two, Dar.
Okay.
Good Canadian beer.
Second thing, Nexus 7.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's always been a policy never to buy anything at its first incarnation.
Yep.
You've got horseshoes up here for Snaris.
Yeah.
Yours truly. One, the first one wouldn't connect. Replacement, same crop, wouldn't connect.
Really?
Yeah. So ended up getting a phablet. on Galaxy Note.
Oh, those are really nice. Those are really nice.
Well, they call them phablets, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so you can put it in your pocket.
Yep.
So.
Yep, they're really nice. The Galaxy Note actually has a pen.
Yeah. I've seen the advertisements for it.
Yeah, you do some really nice things with the Galaxy Note. I have to admit a certain amount of lust for the Galaxy Note. I do love my Nexus 7. The first one I had had a problem with the speakers, but they replaced it with no questions, and the second one's been fine. Both of mine connected just great. Did you get any sort of error message or?
Out of range. And then the second one was authenticating, and it never did. You know, you made a cup of tea and came, returned, and it was still in the loop.
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't.
Well, and sometimes what I've noticed with mine, what I've had to do is, you know, if it's got a connection, sometimes it get confused. So I delete it and then reestablish the connection, and it's happier than all get out.
Yeah, I have to do that on my iPad now, and then I have to forget a network it's known before because it won't connect to it, and then reconnect and retype the password.
Yeah, but she couldn't connect the first time.
Yeah.
So it's very weird. Very weird.
Well, actually, as most bad things that happen to us, we can learn a lot from them. And this Note thing is much more practical.
Yeah, they're very nifty. I really was kind of impressed by that.
And they're, of course, they're coming out with an N7 3G.
Right. The next version of the Nexus 7 will have 3G with it. If you're somewhere where you can't get an internet connection, you can do 3G, only that's, I don't know how useful 3G is with a tablet. 4G,
anyhow.
Maybe.
Yeah. But
what?
Thank you so much for everything.
All right. Thanks, Star. Have a great week.
Yep, you too.
Bye.
I was reading listening to a video podcast where they were talking about the rumors about the iPad mini, 7.85-inch tablet. Just to be a hair bigger than the 7-inch Nexus and the 7-inch Fire. And he was saying that he doesn't quite understand a 7-inch tablet because it's too big to fit in your pocket. He must have small pockets. But it's too small to read things very well versus the 10-inch iPad. And I'm thinking, well, duh, 10 inches is going to be bigger than 7 inches.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, 7 inches is bigger than the 3 or 4 inches on your phone.
Well, and that's
it's easier to read than the phone. So
and you can always pinch and zoom for anything you really need to see. The big problem with a lot of these tablets is they don't present themselves as a mobile tablet or as a mobile browser.
Yeah.
So you get the full-size thing or the site you're going to doesn't have a mobile version.
Yeah.
And that's certainly not the fault of the tablet.
I've run into the opposite sometimes on the iPad because it does publish itself as a mobile device. Some websites force you into the mobile version of the site, but the iPad with a 10-inch screen is big enough to see the full site. In fact, I think my screen is bigger than your screen.
Yeah, it is pretty much. Yeah, it's about the same. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, you're using a netbook. I've got an iPad. It's about the same size screen.
Same screen.
I can use the full-size website, but some sites won't.
Oh, I so didn't want to get into that one.
Yeah.
Hearing you two talk?
Yeah. Well,
let's go to the phone.
Well, let's not. I want to talk, as long as we're talking about Google, let me mention something. Last week we talked, I made an impassioned plea for Google to bring high-speed internet to Rochester. And we do have a new thing. The folks in Kansas City are lucky ducks for getting Google's high-speed internet fiber project deployed there. But what about the rest of us? When will Google bring internet that's 100 times faster and an awesome new high-def pay TV service to us? The answer? Someday. While the company didn't have details, a spokes individual confirmed that Kansas City is just the beginning. We'll be looking at ways to bring ultra-high speed to other communities. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, Google Fiber Project isn't the only gigabit-per-second internet around. Chattanooga, Tennessee's public utility EPB has offered a gigabit fiber to the home connection for about 3 years, but it currently costs about $300 a month. Ditto for Paxio, which offers a gigabit internet connection in the San Francisco Bay Area for about $245 a month. So Google Fiber is unique because it is, one, affordable, and two, includes pay TV. People in Kansas City, both the Kansas and Missouri sides, can get the internet service for free after paying a one-time $300 connection fee or $25 a month for a year. A high-speed internet service plus TV costs $120 a month. Yet high-speed internet service alone is $70 a month. So hurry up, Google, and spread some of that low-cost gigabit internet love around. We are Monroe County, and we are so freaking ready.
We should start a campaign to bring Google Fiber or Google Internet.
There are a couple out there, and we'll get them to the. We'll get them to the.
So inundate Google and say, "Hey, tell you what, your next city that you want to come to, they really get things going is Rochester.
We've got 500 miles of fiber already laid out in Monroe County. We should be using it.
Yes, it's there. Let's use it. And what was it? Five megabytes for free? Weren't they handing out?
Well, and that's just that you get a 5 megabit connection. But you pay if you're going to do that, you pay the $300 connection fee.
Yeah.
Which is $25 a month for a year, and then it's free forever. How hard is that? Or you can pay $70 a month and get gigabit, or you can pay $120 a month and get gigabit and TV. I'm not going to do that until they have BBC America. But once they have that, they have every other station I want. So there you go. Are you ready for Google Fiber? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or, of course, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. And back to the phones. Judy from Henrietta on the line. Welcome, Judy. What's your question?
Hi there. It's Judy from Hilton.
Hilton.
Oh, I'm okay. Sorry. I hit Henrietta.
Yes, he did, but that's okay.
I'm sorry.
How are things in Hilton?
They're terrific. It's the best place on earth to live.
Sure, that's what I hear. What can we do to make you even happier than you are?
I'm back again this week because I was talking to you guys last week about my Kindle Touch.
Yeah.
And learned that the passwords are the same as your Amazon account.
Yeah.
I still have lots of trouble because all I get when I turn it on and, you know, go forward is a little box with numbers in it like a calculator. I can't get to the keyboard.
Sounds like it's asking for the personal lock screen of the device itself, not your app, your Amazon password.
Oh, man.
So it's like a 4-digit PIN you have to type in that you set up on your Kindle to lock it before it gets in. The danger of the Kindle is that, similar with the iPad, is that if you leave it unattended, someone gets into your device, they could potentially go to the store and buy stuff on your account. So a lot of people, and it's generally recommended, to put a pin lock or screen lock or keyboard lock on the device so that you have to type in this 4-digit PIN, or you can also switch it to an actual password
to
open it up and use it.
Okay. Well, what happens if you forgot what that was?
We're Googling around.
Well,
to see.
That's an interesting problem. Which Kindle device do you have?
Touch.
The new one.
Well, I bought it off Amazon, and I don't know if it's the new one or what.
There might be a reset button on the back of it.
I'm thinking you have to erase it and start over again, because that's the way it is on the iPad.
Yeah. Did you just get an update recently?
No.
That's interesting, because there was an update that rolled out that suddenly turned on passwords by default.
Oh, dear.
And the update did it automatically.
Does it list how many digits you need for the password?
No.
Got a pencil?
Okay.
1-1-1-3-3-3-7-7-7.
Oh, you're a devil. Wait a second.
Apparently this is a...
3 1s, 3 3s, and 3 7s.
Yeah. Apparently there is a default password block that
could
get turned...
Could you just run that by me one more time?
1 1 1.
1 1 1.
3 3 3.
3 3 3.
7 7 7.
Okay.
Because if you didn't intentionally set a pass lock, that may have been it as well. But now for the second and third generation Kindle, you said it's a Kindle Touch?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. It's a different default password. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. That was fourth generation Kindle. Kindle Touch is 1-1-1-2-2-2-7-7-7.
Okay. So I'll do that one, and then what'll that get me?
Theoretically, that gets you into the Kindle that that will be back up and running the way you're used to. And then you can go into the settings application and change that screen lock passcode.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess for some reason, you know, I must have been...
Well, it may not have been you. It may
A lot of people are complaining that the recent update...
An auto update you might not have noticed happened.
...turned on passwords by default.
Oh.
Which is a good security precaution, but they shouldn't turn it on with a password you don't know.
Yeah, really.
Right.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is, once you're in with 111-222-777, go into your settings and change... Either change the password or turn off passwords.
Oh.
That way you'll either know what the password is or you won't have one.
Yeah.
It is, it's a good idea to have some sort of a pass lock, especially it's a little hard or easier on the Kindle, isn't it? You can buy something without putting your password in.
Well, and yeah, the big thing for you, because you don't have private information except for your Amazon purchasing information.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if they purchase something, well, I suppose they could purchase
change
it
the shipping
gift.
Address.
Yeah. So you do want to be careful. It is certainly a better idea to have a password than not.
On the iPad, it does ask for your password to make a sale. If somebody wants to buy something on your iPad, you have to put in a password.
So it's not a bad idea to have a password. It's just a bad idea to have a password that you never set.
Is there a difference between a password and a pin lock?
No, I'm calling it a password.
One
it's just
the same.
Some private way to get into your system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, some people are calling it a passcode now because it shouldn't be a word in the because words are in the dictionary and it's easy to break.
Yeah, phrase, really.
Originally, I had a word and then three numbers after it.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't have any way to put it in, so I converted it
all
to numbers, and that didn't work either.
Yeah, so that's probably your Amazon password.
Yes,
not the Kindle password, which is separate.
So there you go. So do that 111-222-777, and at least you'll be in. You can turn it off or change it to a PIN number that you know.
You guys are great.
Thanks, Judy. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye
bye.
What an interesting update that is. Oh yeah, we just randomly decided that what we needed to do was set a password for you that you don't know. Nice.
That's ridiculous.
And my favorite part is that Amazon is saying they're baffled. We're baffled by this.
Why are passwords are good? You should be happy we turned a password.
Well,
on.
Right. They're not saying they're right. What are they baffled about? Are they baffled about the fact that it happened, or the fact that we're complaining that it happened?
Yeah.
Although they really shouldn't be baffled by the fact that we are angry that we don't know the password.
Yeah.
You always should set a password on all of your devices, on your phone, on your tablets, on everything else. Oh, yes, I know. How difficult is that? Now when I turn it on, I have to actually type in a number. Don't think of it as something that prevents you from getting in. Think of it as unlocking a door. So you're being welcomed into your machine and everybody else is blocked.
Yeah.
It's safer to do that, and it's certainly a better thing to do than to just leave it laying around open to anybody to get in and do anything. The more powerful our devices are, the more they need a good, strong passphrase. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Lynn from Climber on the line. Welcome, Lynn. What's your question?
I have a question about hard drives, in particular Western Digital. Typically, when you go to a website and you're looking at different drives, you have the option in Western Digital between black and blue and
green
and red currently. Yesterday, I ran into one that is different and at a pretty darn good price. It's not called any of those categories. It's AV-GP. It's a 2 terabyte SATA 2 hard drive with 3 gigabytes per second rating.
Yeah. The green drives are low power and therefore energy efficient, but they're also slower and a little cheaper. The black drives are faster, 7,200 DPM, typically have a longer warranty and more expensive. Mm-hmm. The blue drives are pretty much in the middle between green and black. I haven't heard of red before, but the AV drives are for audiovisual people that are doing high-speed video recording or audio recording, so they need as fast as they can get. They're usually 10,000 RPM. And significantly more expensive because of the higher speed rating and the higher throughput of them, and also usually a higher warranty, too. So if you've got a good deal on an AV drive, that's probably pretty good.
Well, this was a 2 terabyte, and I think it was, what, $109 or something like that?
That is good.
Yeah, jump on it.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, but I thought, well, if it's specialized... It's ones and zeros. How can it be that specialized?
It's just optimized for faster throughput.
Mm-hmm.
Usually that would show up in an enterprise section on their website versus a home section. And it gets faster and faster and faster for people that need ultra high speed. So a database server, your giant Oracle server with 100,000 customers, you need the fastest drive as you can get.
So it's a weird combination of things, though, Lynn, because it's AVGP, right?
It was AV-GP.
Next higher one up, well, that's the 3.5-inch version. Then right. There's an AV-25, which is the 2.5-inch
version.
Well,
the GP version is green power. So although it says it's faster, green power generally means a slower spindle speed. So it must have an awfully big cache.
64 meg cache.
Yeah, there you go.
At the high end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also designed to be long-term reliable, very quiet, reduced power consumption. And they use something, there it is, it's they're using Silkstream. That's a smooth, continuous digital playback thing. And you can actually stream up to 12 simultaneous HD streams. So it's also got IntelliPark and preemptive wear leveling. So it's a really nice device. And I would say that's about $50 off the lowest price I've ever seen.
That sounds about right compared to what I spent.
Yeah.
A similar drive, but not with that lettering.
Yep.
Let's put it that way.
And the XE series drives are the 10,000 RPM model, so they're the super fast one.
Well, it seems like something I read on this somewhere was, it might not have been on this site, was that maybe it's a variable speed, that maybe it picks up speed when they're looking for higher throughput or something.
And it could slow down when it's not being used as
right.
much, so it doesn't use as much power.
Oh, well,
right.
More importantly, it's slow write, fast read.
But maybe it's cheap because it's SATA 2.
Well, that'll do part of it. But the big thing about the AV drives is they're slower to write but faster to read.
Oh, okay.
So generally, you don't really care about writing because the stuff that... Well, it depends on what you do. But if you're just the average user, you don't do a lot of writing to begin with.
Right.
So faster read is good for you.
Well, I'm going to be using this... Well, my plan is to use this for a number of different things until I finally maybe end up with it in a Drobo, maybe.
There you go.
Anyway, I just wanted to know first. It didn't make sense to me because I thought that was a heck of a good price.
No, it's a heck of a good price. I say go for it.
Yep.
I say go for it.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah, it's a pretty decent drive. It's not going to be the fastest to write.
See, I would have thought the otherwise because it's for video streaming, so you're reading off of it. The usual AV drives are for writing video. You're recording from a camera to the drive. You want them to write as
right,
fast
but
as
this
they
is,
can.
This is for streaming out. So if you were running a streaming server or whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Our next caller is Joan from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Joan. What's your question?
Hi. My question is, do they have, you know how they have the books, Computers for Dummies?
Yeah.
Do they have a dummy book for Google? I'm having such a horrible time with it, and I'd like to know how to become more efficient at using it.
That's a lovely question.
Maybe. We've always said that searching is kind of an art, that two people can type search phrases into Google, and I see this all the time with myself. My wife will come at me, and she's been Googling things for an hour and can't find what she wants. I go in my first search, I find exactly what she's looking for.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a guy thing, huh?
Yeah, well, on Amazon, if you're an Amazon buyer, you can, in fact, buy a book called Google for Dummies.
Okay, that's good to know.
And
I might do that because it's so frustrating when I go to look something up and I get 10 different things at places that sell the stuff or have really has nothing to do with what I want to find out. And
yeah.
I think that I am addressing it correctly when I go in.
Yeah, I see that a lot, too, and it really annoys me. Like when I was just looking for the Western Digital AV drives, I found 10 places to buy them.
Uh-huh, okay.
And the actual Western Digital website was way down on the list. So one of my tricks is there's parameters you can put in, and so I did site:wdc.com.
Which is Western Digital.
Western Digital Corporation. So that limits your search to a specific site.
Wait a minute, now what was that?
Site:, and then the name of the site. So let's say you wanted to search for something that you specifically knew was on the Soundbites website. And let's say you were searching for donut, and you wanted something that you remembered seeing on the Soundbites website. Well, you can just search for donut. You're going to get 100 gazillion things that aren't going to help you any.
Okay.
But if you search for donut space site : soundbites.org with no spaces, S-I-T-E : soundbites.org, then it will search for donut solely on the Soundbites website. And Steve apparently found something.
No, I found nothing.
Oh, there you go.
Nothing on our website about donuts.
There's nothing on our website about donuts.
Okay, well, that's good. Then
well, we'll have to fix that.
Well, that's interesting, because that should search the forums too, right?
Yeah, when apparently nobody's talked about donuts.
Oh, dear. Well, okay, guys.
Did you search
for
D-O-U-G-H or just D-O-N-U-T-S? All right, thanks, Lynn.
You do a great job. I listen to you every week, and I don't know a lot of what you're talking about, but I feel like I am learning more. So
thank
that
you.
Makes sense.
That's what we're here for.
But I thank you again, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
So there are a million different things you can do with Google. Did you know that you can...
Oh, I'm spelling sound bites wrong, idiot.
Well, there's your problem. Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you.
No, I forgot the D.
Oh, sound bites?
Yeah, because the D and the B are right next to each other.
Yeah, right. you can search... You can do all kinds of things. You can say...
There we are. 4 results about donuts.
There you go. Probably not counting the fact that I just wrote in that thing. We don't talk about donuts on our website. The other thing is that you can also, for example, go to the Google search bar and type in, say, convert 32 meters to feet.
Yep.
Hit enter and you get an answer.
And it does math. Or
actually, you don't even have to do the answer anymore.
What is the mass of the Earth?
Okay.
We were talking about that. What was I looking? Oh, go ahead and do the call.
Yeah, we only have a minute left. So our next caller is Joe from Buffalo. Hiya, Joe. What do you know?
I have an asymptotic to zero chance of getting Google Fiber because Fios already goes by my house, and I doubt they want to try and compete with that, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're at zero for every select value of zero.
Anyhow, what I really wanted to call about is I kind of like K9 for an IMAP client on Android.
Sure.
But and it is pretty good.
Yeah.
But as you saw me posting on Google Plus, it has this annoying habit of every time you run it, it puts it into the let's start it on boot list, which having so little RAM, I don't know as I want it starting up every time I boot. You have any suggestions for another IMAP client?
I have been using the regular one that comes with what you call it, and with Android. And I haven't been using. I have been using it on my tablet. I don't use anything on my phone. I have used K9 and. Of course, I've got 32 gig in my phone, so it didn't bother me. So that wasn't a problem for me. I don't know that it has any other settings where you can simply say, yeah, no. But I'll look it up. I'll look into it, and I'll let you know.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I'm not going to promise to find anything. I'm just going to look into it. There's a difference. All right, thanks, Joe. We're actually done for another week, so I want to thank each and every one of you who called in. I want to apologize to those of you to whom we did not get, but you know whose fault that is. That's right, it's yours, because you did not follow the Chicago method of calling. Call early, call often. We are going to be gone for a whole week, but you can join us at soundbites.org. And there's amazing stuff still going on here. The German show is next. It's the best German music you'll hear all week. And we'll be back next week with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 55 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on the truly great, member-supported Jazz 90.1.